Okay, we're gonna get started. First of all, thank you, Yael Yitzchak, for having us this year, and thank you, Reb Ari Marburger, for his warm introduction throughout his presentation. So thank you very much. The initial plans for today's presentation named our presentation something about estate planning, but we've really focused it on trying to deal with insurance trusts primarily, which is obviously an important issue for everyone, you know, here today. And we're going to start out initially just with some very basic estate planning pointers, which I think is very relevant and prevalent amongst, you know, everyone's clients here today. And these are mostly issues that over the course since CSB 5 that we've seen either insurance professionals call us about or clients having these issues, but mostly really practical issues that come up and are perhaps not entirely clear to everyone, and we'd like, hopefully, after this presentation, we'll create some, you know, clarity in these issues. The way we're going to deal with it, again, we're going to start some very basic points, very short about estate planning generally, and then we'll spend the majority of the time talking about insurance trusts, and we're going to do it how we generally do it, but everyone, Hill wasn't happy last year. I had him play the woman in the skit that we did, and I've got some feedback over the year. It didn't work out too well, for me at least. So this year we're going to keep it gender neutral. So we're going to still do it in question and answer format, and we'll take it from there. So generally, you know, insurance professionals, we find obviously you don't walk into someone's house or into their office and say, look, I've got with me a guy who's ready to take your blood, sign here on a $2 million policy. Generally, you know, there's a few meetings trying to explain the need for the policy, maybe something about estate planning, and then ultimately the goal at the back, very far back end, is to make the sale, obviously. But so initially there are questions about estate planning that come up. So we'd like to start with that.
Okay, so I'll be asking the questions to the attorney on generally, you know, why, what a agent should know, what to explain to their clients about estate planning in general, what's the importance about estate planning.
So really, when talking to a client, obviously the main component is a big part is the worst case scenario. That's why many people are purchasing insurance, life insurance to begin with. It's the worst case scenario, and the worst case scenario for a client to understand is if there's a married client, the worst case scenario is if that both the husband and wife who have minor children should pass away simultaneously. Then that's the disaster situation, and ultimately their children would wind up without any documents in place. They would wind up sort of becoming the ward of the court, so to speak, until people get involved, and it could be a major issue. That's obviously the worst case scenario, which it's hard to sometimes for people to even contemplate such a tragic scenario.
Is there anything else besides for that very rare catastrophic case that most people don't think will happen to them?
Right, so that's definitely an issue where we'll call it the second worst scenario, where one of the either the husband or the wife die, and if they don't have any documents in place, then there's an issue that can come up in terms of intestacy. Basically, the state then says where the assets should go. That doesn't mean it goes to the government, but the state decides. Every state has its own rules in terms of intestacy, and it may not follow the wishes of the person. Specifically, if there's a unmarried person who never had children, then that's a scenario where that type of person may have a very specific way the person wants to leave it, and intestacy would say it goes to maybe his or her siblings, which may not be the way that he wants it to be.
Well, what about the typical situation, you know, a couple with children, one marriage? How bad is intestacy in such a situation? What would the state say? Where should everything go?
So it really depends in what state the person's living at the time of death or considers himself to be living. And in New York, someone doesn't have a will, everything would go, 50% would go to the spouse, 50% would go to children. And that's potentially not something which the person wants. And in New Jersey, actually, in a typical family setting where there's been one family, one marriage, you know, one group of children, there would actually go to the surviving spouse. But the problem in New York would be someone can have business interests that suddenly go to minor children, and it can completely put a business for a very long period of time at risk of different issues that someone would grapple with.
And we already heard about the halachic problems and the problems in Bezdin about, with intestacy from Rabbi Marburger.
And then the one other point is that generally leaving things without a will, it goes outright to the person, and that may not be the best situation either, because a child may have creditors, a child may have special needs, a child may have other reasons why assets should not go outright. And with a document in place, it could really take care of those issues.
Are there any estate tax issues with intestacy caused by intestacy?
So it particularly in New Jersey and in New York, but we'll start with New York, really for if everything goes 50% to children, there could be a person could lose the deferral of the estate tax exemption, because if 50% is going to children as opposed to a spouse, there's a 100% marital deduction, which would then be lost. So 50% of the assets, if it's above the federal exemption, which right now is high, almost $5.5 million, there would be a risk of really having a 50% of the estate being taxed immediately.
Are all types of assets governed by intestacy rules?
So certain assets, if they're owned jointly, whether it's bank accounts or other types of, or ownership of property that's owned jointly, that wouldn't follow intestacy, it would go to the surviving owner. And that would resolve a big part of the issue, so long as that's, again, the way that someone wants that asset to go. When it comes to ownership of businesses and partnerships, that's another way that people can plan, where the documents, which we've seen in general, people don't have proper business agreements in place, where people could really set up the business agreement, where the agreement can say, following this person's incapacity or death, who should become the manager, who should become the owner, and it could be done outside of the will and outside of a trust and outside of any other court necessitated document.
So I guess now we'll move over to life insurance in general and the life insurance trust in particular. What are the benefits of placing life insurance policy in a trust?
So the benefits of putting life insurance in a trust, and I touched on this before, is that when assets are held in a trust, there could be a certain level of control on how the assets are distributed, how they're spent, how soon they're distributed, and it creates a level of credit protection for the people who ultimately become the beneficiaries. Other than talking about the tax issues that it can resolve, but just simply, as far as the manner of distribution, really the trust can be a very practical way to deal
with tax issues. Isn't life insurance proceeds completely not subject to tax?
So that's a question we often see and hear, that people have this misnomer that insurance proceeds are not taxable. And we know that, yeah, there is a concept that it's not taxable, but that's only from an income tax perspective, that the recipients are not taxed from income tax. But there are many people who don't realize that there's actually an estate tax, which would be due to the estate of the person who died owning the policy based on the death benefit. So it sort of follows how Marburger was explaining, like the IRS takes the approach that it's Shah Achas Kaidem or Rega Achas Kaidem. A lot of people ask, well, what do you mean it's not part of, it wasn't worth anything but when he died. It was just a death benefit. But they look at it that way. They have the lumdisha way of looking at it, I guess, when it comes to that.
Can we achieve the same benefits of controlling the assets for future generations? Not the tax benefits, but the family benefits, so to speak. Can you achieve the same thing with the revocable trust, or in a different way of using a trust?
Yeah, so a revocable trust is a trust that we often implement for estate planning purposes together with a will. We sort of describe it as, just to give a very basic explanation, it's really a will together with a revocable trust for different estate planning reasons that we do that. We're not going to talk about that, but essentially, it ultimately, after death, it becomes irrevocable, and it would accomplish the same the same thing that an irrevocable trust would accomplish.
Other than the tax.
Other than the tax, as you mentioned, right, yes.
Now, I have certain clients that have existing trusts for other assets. Is there a benefit of creating a separate trust for insurance, or can you just put the insurance policy into the general irrevocable trust?
So that we've seen often, a client is told they should own the policy in a trust, and they say, well, I have a trust, great. Now I could use my trust. And what comes up is that there's one issue that there's certain provisions that there's questions whether or not insurance policy that's held by a trust, whether the settlor, the creator of the trust, the previous owner, can have certain rights with regard to the trust that essentially keeps that right for the policy. And it's a question, and it's a comparison between really the Internal Revenue Code has a provision specifically related to incidents of ownership when it comes to insurance policies. And therefore, many practitioners are worried about the settlor, the creator of the trust, having a removal of trustee powers when it comes to owning insurance policies within a trust, as well as having a right to borrow from the trust. And that's something which is questionable, and it really depends on the practitioner and how, you know, the approach of that particular lawyer.
Okay, so now that the insurance trust will own the insurance policy, what do we do now? How do we get the policy into the trust?
Right, so firstly, it's important, a lot of times a client will, and we've seen this, a client, you know, speaks to a lawyer or an agent, and they deal with the trust, but they don't sign it. And suddenly, and somehow, they then transfer it to a trust, but the trust was either never signed, things like that happen. So it's important to make sure the trust is signed correctly, which means it's signed and it's notarized, that the trustee and the grantor signed it. Also to make sure that the policy is updated accordingly and that it's owned correctly. And then once it's owned by the trust, there's the best way to do it is that to purchase the policy, you know, to begin with, you know, with the trust, so you don't run into look back periods and you know, things of that nature where it could potentially be includable in the estate for 3 years. Oftentimes, a client will say, "Look, I don't have that much. My net worth, I'm low net worth at that point in time. Their estate is their balance sheet, but they're going to grow." And oftentimes, especially in New Jersey, $1 million policy, the exemption is $675,000. Combined with a married couple, it's double that. But having a house and a $1 million policy can wind up leading to an estate tax. So owning it in a trust to begin with is the best way. But then there's ultimately putting it into the trust if you didn't.
So you have an existing policy that, you know, wasn't owned initially by the trust. Is any way, what's the way of getting it into the trust?
So there's two options. You could sell it to the trust, or you could just gift it to the trust. The issue with selling it is that there's the issue with transferring it is that there's a 3-year look back, as I mentioned before, that it could theoretically be includable in the estate, or would be includable in the estate. The sale to the trust would most likely avoid that scenario of it being includable in the estate, because it wasn't a gift transfer, but it has to be done correctly for the right value. For what the policy is worth. Generally, if it's a term policy, it would be the unpaid, unused premiums. With cash value, it would be usually, again, as this question is exactly whether or not a 712 or it's the unused cash value. Most of the time, that would be the same, but it's not often the case.
Are there any issues with transfer for value issues, income tax issues with selling a policy to a trust?
When someone sells a policy to the trust, so long as the trust is what's called a grantor trust, which means it has certain provisions, which makes basically the trust is a flow through to the individual on the individual's income tax returns, which one provision would be that the trustee is authorized to pay premiums on the life of the settlor. So that would make it a grantor trust, and then effectively it's a sale between the grantor and himself or herself, and therefore there's no, you know, it's one pocket to the other basically, and therefore there would be no income tax effect for that.
Well, what about a case? I actually know about a case that they did a sale to a non-grantor trust, where it's considered a separate taxpayer. Is there any way to fix that?
So long, and there's actually somewhat of an easy fix. So long as that person is still alive, ultimately the realization event hasn't occurred, and then the trust can ultimately pour over the policy to a grantor trust. And so long as at the time of death, the policy was owned by a grantor trust, there wouldn't, even though when it was transferred to the trust, it was actually transferred to a non-grantor trust, the later transfer would resolve that issue.
Okay. Do I lose any benefits by transferring the policy to an irrevocable trust?
So transfer to an irrevocable trust really should not create a situation where benefits are lost. Firstly,
Can I directly access the cash value in the trust?
So the cash value cannot be directly accessed by the person because it's owned by a trust. But the manner in which it could be accessed is if someone has a trust that names the spouse as a beneficiary, then ultimately if they need to access that cash value, the trust can borrow. Can take the cash value, borrow against the cash value, and then ultimately distribute it out to the spouse who's a beneficiary of the trust. And with regard to borrowing against the policy when it's owned by a trust, so there are certain aspects that are simpler. There are certain aspects that are a little bit more difficult. And Valley was here, and they were talking about it. I heard to a lot of people. And basically, when it comes to a trust, the individual isn't really vetted at all. They don't look at the individual's credit or his assets and anything which has to do with the individual. But they do require, from an attorney, and there's their own legal counsel has to look into whether the trustee has the right to do what they're doing, and it becomes a little bit more of a procedure from that angle. So it's really, it's there are benefits and then there's also the consequences, but it's really sort of a wash on some level.
Now, if we either gift the policy to the trust or do a sale by putting cash into the trust, isn't there a gift tax? How do you get around the gift tax issue?
So either way, whether someone's selling a policy to a trust or gifting it to a trust, there's going to be some money first going to the trust, because in order for the trust to purchase the policy, the trust needs funds. So either way, there'll be some gift to the trust. If depending what the value is, the best would be to use annual exclusion gifts, which right now a person can give another person $14,000 a year. A husband and wife can give a person $28,000 a year. So depending on how many beneficiaries there are in a trust, that's how much can be given without having an estate tax, using an estate tax exemption. There may be filing rules as far as a Form 706 for gifts being given, especially if the husband and wife are splitting the gifts. But generally, you would be using what's called crummy powers, which also may require, there's a question, the courts say it does not require crummy notices. The IRS does take the position that it does require crummy notices. And therefore, we generally recommend crummy notices be implemented.
What happens if, after a couple of years, I just don't like the terms of the trust? I don't want that distribution to my children when they turn 25. My children are already 22, 23, and they're not ready to have that amount of money. Well, can I change anything? And it's an irrevocable trust. Can I change the term?
Right. That's it's also a question that we get all the time. I want to change it. And is it such a complicated process? One thing which also comes up, which is an issue which we see, is that people, if they create the trust when they're younger, they don't think they're going to have, children and grandchildren who end up getting married. They don't even think like that far. And having spouses or in-laws as beneficiaries can add dramatically to the amount of annual exclusion gifts someone can get. So sometimes I've seen that where we needed to actually update a trust by decanting, which is a way to resolve this issue if you don't like the terms of a trust, where you could actually take the policy and distribute it to another trust based on the first trust either allowing it, secondly, even if the trust doesn't allow it or doesn't specifically allow it, there is state law that at least under New York State, which has a very, very large, significant laws regarding decanting. And the third way would be to really sell it. There's a way to create a new trust and then put the insurance policy into the new trust, and have cash going from, let's say, from the new trust to the old trust. And therefore, if someone didn't like the way that the $5 million policy would be distributed, but the $5 million policy is maybe worth $200,000 today based on cash value. So if that first trust where the terms are not really what they want today, would end up only having $200,000, while the trust that they like has the death benefit coming out of that trust.
how should I pay for the premiums on the policy once it's in the trust?
Right. So this comes up pretty often, where a lot of clients have joint accounts, and then they want to make the payment out of a joint account, which can somewhat can pollute the trust on some level and create a situation where the spouse who shouldn't be considered a settlor is become sort of a grantor to the trust, and it could create tax implications for them. So the best way is to create a trust account and also have an individual account. That's the min ha-muvchar mahadrin, is to do it that way, really, is to go ahead and have one account that's owned by the settlor of the trust, and that account should be used to pay the premiums to the trust account. That trust account then goes ahead and pays the premiums to the company. Another way, if someone doesn't want to go, is really, you know what, I can't open so many accounts, it's better to not have the trust account, although we don't recommend this, and to at least have an individual account to make the individual account have the payment going directly to the trust rather than from a joint account, even if it's being signed by the settlor. I mean, there are people who do that. It's not deductible for income tax purposes, but it's not the best way either, because it's not really his own account.
Everyone is talking about new tax regulations that are coming out in January relating to discounting.
Yeah, so that's the I'll actually let you can answer your own question on that one. I'm not updated on this. Hull has done all the research on this. So
just very basically, it seems like the IRS has proposed new regulations that will basically completely knock off discounting for minority interest in entities, in family entities, and unless it's some legal challenge, or unless they take the comments that people submit in Washington and in a couple months and really change their plan, it seems like it's going to stay, let's stick like that, and they have to figure out other ways. What?
There's no reason they shouldn't do.
Okay. Yeah.
Ultimately, everyone's estate could go up by 30%,
and
the estates go up by a value of 30%, and there's more funding necessary. One more point, just about also an important point, which people have another misnomer that I just wanted to bring out also, is that people think that their insurance trust is actually going to be paying their estate taxes, and that the insurance, the liquidity, is actually paying their estate taxes. And it's important for the trustee to understand, in particular, that if they do that, then they're first of all giving the IRS the trust money, but then they're going ahead and saying basically that the trust was includable in this person's estate because we use it to pay his taxes. In reality, what it's used for is ultimately just to be able to swap out illiquid real estate or other assets, and to go ahead and have the funds available to pay the IRS, and then to have the assets in the trust and distributed in accordance with how the person wants it distributed.
No, whatever gifts were made, whatever transfers are made before it takes effect, it's fine. Any other questions?
You could.
What would you recommend? What type of a policy should be put into a trust? Term versus a whole life? Both having.
It's the death benefit, really, that you're protecting.
It's about having access to the cash value.
Yeah, so again, you have access to cash value, you have a trust with the spouse as beneficiary, so you're not really losing that access. You can borrow against it, you can use it as collateral. Even a term policy is definitely no reason. Even a whole life policy, I really don't see any reason.
So you're saying if the trust is paying for the estate, that opens up a can of worms, that belongs really to the owner of the estate.
Right. The trust is not going to pay.
The trust can't pay directly the estate tax.
They could do business with the estate, meaning they could sell substitute assets with the estate, which
so
is just doing
assets.
Well, the trust will have cash.
Then it's a sale. It's basically a sale. Essentially, it's a sale between the trust and then the estate.
So you can't have only the life insurance in the trust by itself.
No,
you can,
but it's not going to help you.
No, it will, because ultimately it's whatever is needed for liquidity will then be used to go ahead and pull, transfer. If someone died without their assets, we haven't spoken about someone only having an irrevocable trust with other assets that are not includable in their estate. But if someone has assets that are part of their estate, then they have, they may have an estate tax due. If they have an estate tax due, they don't want to have to sell the build, sell the building. They, if they want to hold, so then
the insurance trust can't just pay it unless it's
right.
So insurance trust will buy the building.
Oh, you're saying
and then
got it.
And then money is in the estate. The cash is in the estate.
What would you say is the chance that the IRS should come and order a trust?
We just had
a nice large estate.
Talk about the gift.
The chance.
Talk about the gift. No, as far as auditing, I mean, it was no. I mean, they definitely right. audit everything on gift, even on gift tax returns.
Gift tax audits are pretty common. I think the number is 30%. I think that's the
30% on trusts.
On just gift,
especially on value, when it comes to value, you know, even if you're providing, you know, big thing we get is, you know, people the appraisals and providing a proper value. You know, ultimately, if it's done correctly, there's less of a chance that you'll actually have an audit because you're giving them, you know, the proper information that they need, and ultimately. If you take a conservative enough approach, then on some level it's respected. It, you know, depends on the situation, but they are estates are audited definitely where they are assets.
Would you recommend on gifting to file a gift tax return if you're doing only the 14,000? You're not doing more. Just the statute of limitations on the valuation that you used.
Well, if someone's giving the 14,000 without gift split, if they're gift splitting, then it's required to do anyhow. But if assuming no gift splitting, then yeah, we do recommend to get the 3-year statute of limitations going.
Well, and does that cause a risk of an audit? How do you balance that?
You can use valuation. Clauses, you know, that adjustment clauses basically say that, you know, if the IRS comes and says that the gift is really worth more, then the gift is really less. The gift is just a dollar amount, not an amount of shares. You know, the ways to protect against the later audit. So.
But it's definitely a recommendation, yes, to file, even if it wasn't joint, it wasn't split gift, because of that reason.
If you have a valuation,
especially especially if there's a value concern. If it's a very simple value and not really so. Questionable, then maybe not as much. But if it's something which could be questioned, it's better to get it over with. Anyway, we'll stop here. We're available for further questions afterwards, and Rabbi Marburger is here still as well. If anyone has further questions, thank you.